Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the History of Rock podcast. His name is Brandon. He's the DJ.
His name is Shim. He's the rock star. Class is in session as we're talking about Ozfest. We're still on technically 99 because we're still talking about this documentary that was never released, but we're going to get into the further dates of Ozfest, how it kind of whittled down through the years and eventually kind of became no more. But we've already talked about Sharon kind of battling it out with a preacher who was protesting them. And we've talked about sort of the security guards and the roadies and all the other stuff. But we're diving right back into Ozfest here, where Ozzy, he tells a story where he was playing his first Sabbath album for his family, and his dad's response to hearing that first Ozzy album was, "Son, are you sure you're just drinking alcohol?"
That's the response you want from your kin, isn't it?
Well, I mean, he's the Prince of Darkness, man. I mean,
I know. That actually begs the question: Do you ever get that type of commentary from your family over the content that you create? You ever show it to someone and they go, "Are you sure you think this is going to work? Are you sure about that? Whatever."
No, not necessarily. I do get feedback from my family about certain things. But no, for the most part, as my numbers kind of have continued to go up on YouTube and TikTok and Instagram, knock on wood, it continues to do that. They've kind of learned, like, just like trust Brandon, trust what he's doing, because
there you go.
Obviously, what he's doing is working. So,
as they were wrapping up the documentary Back to Ozfest, they ask Ozzy, "Do you think of yourself as a living legend?" And he responds, "Oh, I think of myself as just Ozzy. The luckiest son of a bitch on the planet." That's Ozzy. That's what Ozzy sounds like.
I mean,
he really is. Yeah.
I mean, it's a little bit of luck, but obviously some of it's talent and the stuff that he brought to the table. And the fact that
a lot of it's, here's the thing.
Did they do a genetic test on him and to find out that, yeah, like, he's wired differently? Like, there's a reason he's been able to do the amount of drugs and shit that he's done and not die. Like,
he really should be dead. But no, people underestimate stuff like that. You go, some of it's luck, some of it's talent, but there's no way that you can have a 40-plus year career without real hard work. Or just maybe the luck is in the genetic coding that allows him to do that much drugs, because you could put that much drugs into anyone and be like, go and do things, and they'll get shit done.
Well, this always kind of reminded me of Hunter S. Thompson and how he kind of created his own genre of writing. He was brilliant. He was funny. Yeah. He was insightful on things. But one of the underlying themes with Hunter S. Thompson is that he was constantly on drugs. Yeah. Did you ever see the laundry list of the shit that he said that he did on a daily basis?
No, sure it was.
Okay, hold on. I'm making a note so we can cover that, because it... There's no way that it's possible, the amount of... it's like 10:15, bump of coke. 10:30, three more bumps of coke. 10:45, fifth of Jack Daniels. And it's like, you'd fucking die, man.
Yeah. No, but his thing was, he built his tolerance up over years and years and years because he wanted it to influence his writing. He was like, I'm going to write under all these different psychedelics and different layers and stuff and see how it affects his writing. And it was... You created genius, unfortunately.
And that's also what was the point that I was going to make, is that unfortunately it also led a lot of people to believe that if I just do drugs, I'll be a creative genius. And that's not the case, man. Like, it's you can be inspired. Like, there's certain people that they get the inspiration by being on something. But to think that, if I just do drugs, I'll be creative and I'm going to be amazing. There's a lot of people that have fallen into that trap, and it has not turned out well for them, because I think they came to the realization, maybe I'm just not that creative of a human being.
I have never, ever written anything worth listening to when on drugs, period. No, everything I write, if I'm on anything, it's just, it's like you're working at 50%. And the reason is usually because, and this is just me, I stop thinking about anyone else. Drugs make you completely selfish. They make you completely in your own head, thinking about what you want, what you're doing. So you're not thinking about, I'm going to write something or create something so that the other person hears it and feels a certain thing. Right? So when you do that, you when you come at it from a compassionate perspective of like, I'm gonna write this because I want the other person to feel a certain way or whatever, basically just make them feel something, that's your job. If you come at from a selfish place of drugs, and you just want, you come back the next day, I would come back the next day, it sucks. I'd hear it and go, I'm so glad I didn't show this to anyone, because it's embarrassing. Well,
do you think that part of that is how drugs affect you? Because I don't think drugs affect everybody that way.
No, I'm talking about me. That's how they affect me. But it is how I think it affects a lot of other people. Sometimes if you have one or two drinks and it opens up the vulnerability, and then you go, oh, okay, I'm going to write this, or I'm going to have this thought that normally I wouldn't let myself have because I don't want to be that vulnerable. That's fine. But when you get to the point where you're smashed and you can't even think straight, nah, it doesn't work for me. I'm done. I'm going to get there before the buzzer.
All right, you made it.
One of these days, I'm going to get into a real passionate rant, and I'm going to have, and then you're going to see me going like, no, one more thing. And you're not going to fucking let me go.
Don't disrupt the 60-second tangent timer. Ooh, that's going to be another t-shirt, the tangent timer. So Tony Iommi admitted that Sabbath was pretty blocked off from the rest of the tour. And like we talked about how Ozzy, he wasn't on the road with them. He would take a plane because he just couldn't be on the buses for that many hours anymore. They would essentially kind of show up, get shuffled over to their trailer, hang out there, and then go up on stage, and that was it. So they weren't really interacting with the rest of the crowd, or like not the crowd, but essentially the people backstage, other bands and everybody else that was working on the festival. And they even asked some of the people who were on the tour with them how they were, and they were like, yeah, like nobody goes and talks to them. Because there's even shots of where, like Tony Iommi or Ozzy or somebody are kind of sitting there hanging out, and it's just everybody else is standing back. And like nobody wants to go approach them because that's kind of like, that's Black Sabbath, you know?
Is it because Black Sabbath says, don't come talk to us? Or just
it doesn't
like,
say that per se, but the way that it comes off is it's really, they're like, we don't want to disturb Black Sabbath.
Yeah.
Like, we
remind me at the end of this to tell you, I'm going to tell you a Prince story about that if I haven't told you before, but we'll do it at the end. And one more side note about the documentary. In 1999, a large bottle of Miller Lite at a show was $6. That's not bad. That's pretty good. What is it now? 20?
Oh, God. I mean, and it wasn't a 40. Like, we're not talking like a 40 ounce bottle, but it was a nice big bottle of Miller Lite. Now, you know, Miller Lite, not the greatest beer, but I mean, if you drink enough, it'll get you drunk. So I just wanted to make a note of that. It was $6 because this guy's drinking. He's like, $6. So then we're stepping out of the documentary. We're moving on to the year 2000 and beyond. There were two compilation albums. One of them covered the 2001 lineup and the other one covered the 2002 lineup.
In 2004, they did a reality show where Ozzy and Sharon hosted a show on MTV titled Battle for Ozfest, where they chose 8 bands out of hundreds to compete for a spot at the following year's festival. That's pretty cool. That's a pretty great opportunity for bands, don't you think?
I mean, it is, but it's all bands that were kind of on that cusp anyway, especially when you find out who won. So Ozzy selected one member from each band to tag along the tour, and then they would compete in various challenges. Now, this is 2004.
Oh, so it was like a reality show.
Yeah. See? And because this was after the Osbournes had become a huge hit for MTV. So the winner was Mark Serrano of A Dozen Furies. He was already on Ozfest the previous year with his band Unloco.
Right.
So it's not like he was getting something that he hadn't experienced before. Now, we played Unloco heavily on the college radio station that I worked at. That was a big band, but they were very short-lived. And obviously by this time, you know, he was already, you know, in 2004, he was already onto another band called A Dozen Furies.
Right. All right. So now we're getting into, there is an
not
issue.
Not as good as screaming at demons, though.
Yeah, shut the fuck up. Shut up. There's an issue with, screaming at demons is like that girl that you date after a real relationship where all your friends are like, yeah, I remember that phase. Yep. There's an issue with Iron Maiden on the 2005 tour. During Iron Maiden's final performance, they were pelted with eggs, bottle caps, and ice. This was brought on by Sharon Osbourne because Iron Maiden lead singer Bruce Dickinson had ridiculed Ozzy's need for a teleprompter during his performances. He also mocked the Osbournes show on MTV, not the competition, the show that followed the family.
Yeah. So during three.
What do you expect?
From who?
What do you expect? From Iron Maiden singer. It's fucking Iron Maiden.
From either of them? Like, this all plays out exactly how I figured it would play out. With Bruce Dickinson saying this and Sharon Osbourne reacting the way that Sharon Osbourne reacted.
Yeah.
I mean, it's pretty on par. So during three of Iron Maiden's songs, the PA was shut off. Dickinson could be heard accusing the promoters of cutting off his mic. I've only been to one show where they actually cut the microphone off, and that was when Edema was performing. And I guess we were breaking the sound ordinance for the park that we were at, so they shut, and they had just started performing. And maybe the second song, power goes out. So everybody's thinking somebody bumped something. What's the big deal? It's not the end of the world. So then it got to the point where they started performing again. And then lo and behold, poof, the power goes out again. And then is it Mark Chavez? Yeah, the lead singer of Edema, by the way, who's related to Jonathan Davis. I'm standing right back where the ramp is to come backstage. He comes over and he leans on the rail. And he's fucking pissed. And I just hear him go, I don't fucking need this, man. And then he just fucking walks down the ramp and walks away.
Wow.
And then they were like, we need to go get him. So then, first of all, they're trying to figure out what the fuck is going on with the show. Why is the power going out? And it was because we were breaking this noise ordinance. And then it became, I think it was myself and a couple of people, we had to go get him and like convince him to come back up on stage. He did. He did.
Yeah.
So it worked out for everybody. Yay.
We should have had the 60-second timer for that. After Iron Maiden left the stage, we'll get used to it, guys. We're getting used to it. After Iron Maiden left the stage, like and subscribe, Sharon came on stage to say that she loved Iron Maiden, but thought Bruce Dickinson was a prick.
Which, she's not the only person that's ever said that Bruce Dickinson is a prick. So in 2006, Dickinson responded to this incident by saying, did I have a go at Ozzy and Black Sabbath? No. Why would I? But do I find the Osbournes TV series loathsome and the whole cult of reality TV? But I do find the Osbournes TV series loathsome and the whole cult of reality TV celebrities disgusting.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. I mean, do you think Ozzy enjoyed it? You just said he was high the whole time. He probably got high to fucking deal with it. Sharon comes up and is like, yo, we're the one place where you don't have to deal with cameras and questions. Fuck that. We're going to let him in and do what they want to do. And he's like, oh, whatever. You Sharon. Okay.
Well, it's interesting, too, because the documentary, I'm wondering if they used the documentary to sell MTV on the TV show, because
totally
the documentary ended with them in their doorstep at that house where the Osbournes was filmed and them waving bye, we'll see you again.
Yeah, nothing about Sharon Osbourne is not planned meticulously. She's a genius.
Yeah.
And don't get me wrong, I'm not saying anything bad about Sharon Osbourne. I'm saying I wish I'd had a manager like Sharon Osbourne. She's a fucking gangster.
Yeah.
But Ozzy probably didn't want to do half the shit that she lined up. So what's the easiest way to get around it? Just get high. That's how every guy in a band gets around doing shit they don't want to do.
And that's how every guy on the planet, not just in a band, every married guy on the planet gets around that shit.
Yeah. So,
or I should say most.
In 2007, it was announced the festival would be free that year. Tickets were available through sponsor websites, the Ozfest website, and those buying an advance copy of Ozzy's new album, Black Rain. So by buying a copy of the album, you got a ticket to the festival.
But you could also get the free tickets elsewhere as well, which I always found odd. And I still remember that album because, again, this was at the time when I was working in Florida at 93 Rock. And I Don't Want to Stop, I think, was the name of the single, the first, like, the big single on that one. And he used auto-tune. And everybody was like, whoa, like, this is weird. We've never heard, like, we never thought we'd hear this. So the sponsorship money provided the revenue for the tour, but organizers did not pay the bands for performing. Some of the major acts that year included Ozzy as the headliner, not Sabbath, but Ozzy, Lamb of God, Static X, and Hatebreed. So Static X,
they clearly, all played for free.
They were there had to have been a way that they got paid. If anybody knows, comment below. If you have the in on that one, because essentially it was that the sponsorships wasn't the money to pay the bands, it was to pay for the venues.
Yeah. Yeah, please let us know, because I can't imagine Lamb of God, Static X, or Hatebreed playing
performing
free.
For free.
Yeah, yeah. Like, when you're an up-and-coming band that you never heard of, you play for free all the time, but those are some significant players. There ended up being a lot of issues with these tickets. The heavy load on Live Nation's secure servers caused problems with the redemption of the tickets, and many eBay scalpers charged fans for tickets that ended up being bogus. Fuck yeah. On July 26th, Ozfest ended up giving away free tickets without requiring a redemption code to get past these issues. Yeah. Giving shit away for free, it's always... That's why Woodstock 99, they did it right. Lock that shit down.
Yeah. Yeah, that worked out so fucking well for them.
Yeah.
On August 16, 2007, 83 attendees were arrested at the show, most of them underage. Two men also died at that show, one of them overdosing on alcohol and energy drinks.
Oh, shit. Yeah, that's a bad combo.
How to make your heart explode.
Yeah, yeah, I've done that. It's really fun until it's not. It's really fucking dangerous.
It's really
no,
fun
serious,
until
dangerous.
It's not.
Because you just know, you know the deal, right? You keep the energy when you should black out, you don't, and then you keep drinking until you're dead.
Yeah.
Or you walk in front of a bus. Like, yeah. I should be dead.
Like, that's the thing that I always thought was interesting with people who remember when vodka Red Bulls were like the biggest thing.
Yeah.
It's, dude, you're drinking an upper and a downer at the exact same fucking time. Like, what do you think's going to happen?
It's a great time, but it turns you into an asshole. At least it turns me into an asshole. Because, like, normally the alcohol is supposed to chill you out, be like, yeah, man. And instead it's like, let's fucking go. Yeah, man. Let's
or like,
what the fuck is your problem?
What was it? Four Loko. Four Loko. Maybe was that the one that had, like, energy in
those
it?
Those are
like
some
that?
Nasty drinks. Dude.
I never
that's
had one. Did you actually
shit.
Drink it?
No, I heard about it. I had already had my period where I was like Red Bull vodka, and then I was like, cool, I don't do that anymore. And when I heard about those, what is it called again? Loko?
Four Loko.
Four Loko. Yeah, as soon as I heard about it, I was like, that's an accident waiting. That's a lawsuit waiting to happen.
Yeah.
Seriously. People are going to die
something
on this
happen.
Shit.
By the way, I also need to make a note to cut out the part where you just said, I already had my period. It was way too perfectly timed. Where you paused
in 2000,
right
okay.
after it.
Yeah. In 2008, they didn't do a full tour. There was just, all I think about is my period now that you've said that. I can't get it out of my brain. There was just one date in Frisco, Texas, near Dallas, with Metallica and Ozzy headlining. Other acts included Jonathan Davis, Seven Dust, Devil Driver, Serj Tankian, and In This Moment. Great fucking lineup. There was also a Texas stage that featured Texas bands, including Drowning Pool and Goat Whore.
Yeah!
Love that name. Always love Goat Whore as a band name, dude.
So it was around this time, things started to get a little bit spotty for Ozfest. There was no festival in 2009. And I remember that was a really big deal because, again, this is when I was working in rock radio. And especially down in South Florida, where I'm at now in El Paso, a lot of these bigger festivals don't necessarily stop here, but where I was at, that's where they would either start the tour or end the tour. Because it's, you know, where it's at, it's a pain in the ass if you're like in Orlando and then you come down and then you go up to Tampa. It's just really out of the way for a lot of people. So we were usually the last stop on some of these tours. So then in 2010, that version didn't necessarily have some of the biggest acts out there. I mean, obviously there was Ozzy, Motley Crue was on that one. Halford, which is Rob Halford's project, plus Devil Driver, Nonpoint, Black Label Society, and Drowning Pool as well.
The boys from fucking Nonpoint.
Yeah, we had them on an episode of Rockstar 101,
yeah,
man.
Yeah, dude, I love those guys. After a couple of years off, Ozfest returned in 2013, but only in Japan. No Ozfest in 2014, and back to Japan in 2015. Japan.
Is that the way that things had timed out, because in 2016... Right. This is the beginning of the Ozfest meets Knotfest, taking place over 2 days, September 24th and 25th in San Bernardino, California. The acts on this tour, so Ozfest, Suicidal Tendencies, Hatebreed, Devil Driver, Black Label Society, Megadeth, Disturbed, and Black Sabbath. Not bad. Right. Knotfest.
Not bad.
Butcher Babies, Trivium, Anthrax, Amon Amarth, Slayer, and Slipknot.
Nice.
But wait till you get this next year of 2017.
All right. 2017, it was Ozfest meets Knotfest again on November 4th and 5th in San Bernardino. Ozfest had Deftones, Prophets of Rage, and Ozzy Osbourne. Pretty cool. Knotfest had Stone Sour, Marilyn Manson, and Rob Zombie. Nice. That's
so. If you had to pick, no, there was more. I picked the top names. Like it wasn't just those just like the only acts. Like those were kind of the top names. So if you had to pick between 2016 or 2017, which one would you go with?
Here's the thing. I love Stone Sour, but I would go with the Ozfest that had Deftones and Prophets of Rage.
I was pissed because Prophets of Rage did come through here in El Paso, but especially when I was working on the morning show, going to see concerts, it was a chore, to say the least. And it took a lot.
Well, because people forget the concert's on from like 9 to midnight and you got to be up at 3 or 4 in the morning to get ready for radio again. You can't do it every night. It sucks.
Yeah, but I mean, I would make exceptions. I mean, I went and checked out A Perfect Circle when they came through town. And I would have done it for Rage. If I was still working on the morning show, I would have gone to the Rage shows. There's no way I would have missed that shit. But yeah. Prophets of Rage came through town, and unfortunately I wasn't able to see them, but apparently they put on one hell of a show.
Yeah.
So in 2018, final note here on Ozfest, there was an Ozfest held at the Forum in Inglewood, California on December 31st. They had Jonathan Davis, Marilyn Manson, and Ozzy Osbourne.
Isn't Jonathan Davis' solo project kind of chill, though?
It is.
It's not really heavy.
You performed at the one he was at here, didn't you?
Yes.
It's Street Fest. There's not a lot of screaming.
It's not a cold show.
Yeah. Oh, it's definitely not. It's his stuff. He performed some of the stuff that he wrote for Queen of the Damned, and I remember the final song. Oh, and it's all hazy too, man, because you and I hung out fucking late that night. Oh my god. And I remember his final song, he kind of did that Jonathan Davis breakdown with like the the thing that he does like on the song Twist or in the middle of Freak on a Leash and stuff like that. And I remember him yelling to the crowd, "You motherfuckers thought I couldn't do that shit." And then the whole crowd was like, "Yeah, I did, like we wanted that the whole show."
Yeah, yeah. That's the tough thing. I remember when I love Jonathan Davis. I've only met him twice. He seems like a really nice guy. Korn's fucking amazing. But it's got to be difficult when you want to do a side project and it's good, and then you go out and people just go, "Yeah, we don't care. We just want Korn." Like Korn is too fucking big. It's too good. People are like, "Look, we get it. Like we want to put this on in the CD and the car and the fucking put it on the stereo with a glass of wine." That's the sort of. It's not a festival set. Luckily, he doesn't give a shit. He's like, "Yeah, you're gonna pay for it anyway. I'm Jonathan Davis. Suck it." Fucking sit there and listen.
Yeah, because it reminded me of I have some friends who are really big Slipknot fans. And then when Stone Sour's second album came out, I was talking to them about it and they were like, "Yeah, we're not going to listen to that." And I'm like, "What? Like it's a like that second album by Stone Sour is one of my favorite albums. It's an amazing album." And I was like, "Why would you not even give this a shot?" Well, because we're Slipknot fans.
Wait, who said this?
Some friends that I had down in Florida.
Oh.
And I'm right. "So you won't even give it a fucking chance?" And they were like, we're Slipknot fans. We don't care about Stone Sour. And it just blew my mind. And like you just summed it up with Jonathan Davis. It's got to be incredibly hard to try to branch out to something else. I mean, there was Dave Draymond. He went off and did his own thing called, was it called Device, I think?
Yeah, I played with those guys.
And it sounds like Disturbed.
Yeah.
But just like, you know, like every Disturbed song sounds like Disturbed. This band Device sounded like Disturbed. It was just.
Yeah, it's got to be. And that's the thing. Like Dave Draymond has a very distinctive voice. Jonathan Davis has a very distinctive voice. You can make different sounding music. You can try to make another project and you're still going to sound. And you can't blame people. You really can't blame like fans of like you're in one of the biggest and best bands around. You can't blame people for saying, "Can you please do that thing that I really like that I paid for?" You can't blame them. Like, I mean, I've still got, it's been forever since You're Going Down. Like, and that's all, I get messages all the time. "When's another song like You're Going Down coming out? You should do more of that shit." And I'm like, "Yeah, I know. I heard you." I'm working on it. I got to get a few things lined up first. And the fans are like, "Yeah, you've been doing that for years." Yeah, well, it's going to be a few more.
You should do a sequel called Now You're Getting Up.
Yeah.
I don't know. What happens after somebody gets knocked the fuck out or something? Like one of us is going down. It's like, This will show your maturity. You could be like, the song will be about helping that person up.
No, I think I should write a song called Stay the Fuck Down There.
Stay the fuck down, mate. All right, well, that's going to wrap it for this part of the podcast here on the History of Rock. Although I'm glad that we were talking about Jonathan Davis right there at the end, because coming up next week, we are going to be talking about Korn. And the way that I had the History of Rock positioned is that we were kind of doing deep dives into specific albums, and I'm not really sure that we can do that. What I kind of am looking to do with Korn, and it's, I mean, you're still going to get some of this, like, similar format. It's just, it won't just be their debut self-titled album, and it won't just be Life is Peachy or Follow the Leader or Issues. It's, you know, I'm going to create a show sheet that's going to kind of encompass a lot of the stuff that we need to encompass. And then we're just going to kind of roll through it from the beginnings of Korn, back when there as I think Jonathan Davis was in a group called Sex Art. They were also in a group called LAPD that originally started. And this is all top of the memory shit. This is how I used to be glued to anything Korn back in the day. And I think LAPD, they said it stood for Love and Peace, Dude. And then afterwards, they're like, that's kind of lame. So then they were like, oh, it stands for Laughing as People Die. Like, weird shit like that. So, but we're going to get into Korn coming up here. So just a quick reminder, check out the socials. Hopefully down here on Shims, I've put the proper ones for Instagram and YouTube and everything else right there. Otherwise, I'm just going to put a middle finger and be like, you guys can find Shim on your own. Kidding, I won't do that. But on that note, we're going to wrap up this episode. Look forward to Korn coming up. His name is Shim. He's a rock star.
His name is Brandon. He's the DJ. Class is officially dismissed. Okay, wait. Did I time it right?
You fucking nailed it, man. You nailed it. All right, since we're in the encore, I had so many notes here.
For the encore?
Yeah, because, I had mentioned, so you have your Prince story that you wanted to talk about. Really quickly, though, I just wanted to get this one sort of out of the way, is that one of the reasons that we might be missing one or two remix episodes is because Shim and I, we're not going to be able to record. Because I'm going to be in Disneyland with my family. So if you follow my social media,
I'll be around working. I'll be right here still, just waiting for you. I'll just be working.
You'll be just waiting impatiently for me to come back, and I can tell him all about my trip.
Sitting here in a dark room, just like, when is he coming back?
I'll be in Disneyland for that. And then, so we were going to talk about Hunter S. Thompson, and you had a Prince story.
No, my Prince story was, I don't know if I mentioned this to you before. I met a guy who was a producer, and I'm not going to mention his name just because I'm not sure if he would want me to, because he worked with Prince. He got a call from a friend that was like, yo, Prince needs an engineer to just be in his studio like 8 hours a day and also to be on call. So basically you're going to be like half an hour's drive away. You're going to move there and you're going to be Prince's in-house engineer at his studio on his compound, you're going to live somewhere else. So he took the job for like a year and a half, and he went there, and he was, and the deal was, it was like, okay, you don't have the job. You're going to go in on the first day, and Prince is going to decide by the end of the day if he wants you to have the job. The rules are, you don't look at Prince. You don't talk to Prince, and you just do what Prince tells you to do. And that's it. So he walks in and he sits at the desk. And he's like got things ready to be like, okay, I could pull up a guitar sound. I could pull up a vocal sound. I could turn this on. I could get the drum kit ready. I just need Prince to tell me what to do. Prince walks in. My friend turns around and says, hey man, what's up? So what are we working on today? And Prince
looks
at him.
Don't talk to Prince?
Yeah. Apparently, this is the story from my friend. Prince looks at him for a long time and just goes, yeah, we're going to cut some vocals. And then he walks around to the vocal booth. But there was a long pause. He was like, oh, okay. All right. I can't pull that shit with this guy. All right, let's give him a shot. And this friend of mine told me, he was like, I didn't give a fuck. I mean, like, moving there, it's a hassle. It's a good gig. I want to be able to say I had an experience with Prince, but I'm not going to fucking work there for years and not talk to the guy. It's just not happening.
Yeah.
So he was like, so he just walked up and he just broke it down. The first sentence, he was like, what are we doing? Like, I'm here. I'm going to do exactly what you tell me, but I'm not fucking, I'm going to look at you and talk to you, motherfucker. And Prince just was like, all right. And so that was the dynamic. And they got along really well after that. Apparently, like, the vault was real. The vault that had on it and everything. The vault was
real. With all the music and stuff?
With all the music and shit. And no one knew the code. not his managers, not his family, no one. They had to bring in like the most out of the, out, they had to bring in the biggest gear you could possibly bring in to break into that safe.
Jesus.
And because the property, and like they have the property now, like whatever the record label is that, that signed him up, they have that shit now, but they had to destroy half the studio to get into that fucking safe. Cause the safe was built into the fucking studio.
Yeah.
Apparently it was so dope from what I've heard. So, and the second thing that was fascinating is, he was there listening to, let's call him John, okay? My friend John, he's, and it's just because I haven't got approval from my friend. He says he's working on some shit. And he's, and he says, hey, check out this song by this person. And Prince turns around and goes, that's not music. And so he goes, oh, okay. And he turns it down. Like, don't, you know, whatever. And there's silence while he's getting another thing set up for Prince. And then after a second, Prince says, you want to know what music is? And he just puts his
from
shit down
Prince?
And he turns around.
Fuck,
and he goes, yeah. And he turns around. He's like, sure. And Prince says, real music is me being able to walk into any room on the planet and change how you feel into whatever I want it to be. That's what music is. And he was like, yeah. That's actually a dope. And that's a true response. But to hear it from Prince, to be like, music ain't about nothing. It's not about sounds, vibe, words. It's only about I can make you feel whatever the fuck I want, and I'm going to do it. And he's done it for his whole career. That's all he did. That's why people loved him. It was like, yeah, I just love the way Prince makes me feel.
He was such a fucking pimp, man. Like, the reason, like, why he changed his name, to the fact that the record label told him flat out, like, you owe us another album. So he took some garbage tracks that he knew he didn't like and was like, yeah, fucking here you go.
Yeah.
Like, that was fucking amazing. Yeah. So one of the reasons that we had kind of got on that was we were talking about Hunter S. Thompson before. And like, again, I just the thing with Hunter S. Thompson is that he was so brilliant when he was on drugs that, unfortunately, I think it led to a lot of different people thinking like, oh, if I can just do these drugs, I'll be fine. Because dude, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, it's arguably top three book for me. It's so the lounge lizard scene when he's talking about how the floor is like there's blood on the floor and like this lady's eating this guy's face, all of that stuff. It's just hilarious. And then the movie I thought was a great adaptation of it. It was so good. And it was funny. Like, I don't even like, this is weird conversations that we have with my family. As we were going to brunch yesterday, we were talking about what happens to you when you die. Like, do you get buried or you know, do you get cremated and stuff like that? And I just made
remind me to tell you the game that my son asked me to play with him last night when talking about death. Finish your story.
Oh yeah, so it was me. I made the offhanded comment. I go, I want to be cremated and have my body blown up with fireworks like Hunter S. Thompson.
That's
what he did.
Great idea.
And I think it was Johnny Depp that paid for it. I think.
Yeah. Probably.
But then my wife's like, you want to be cremated? And I'm like, well, yeah, because if you do that, like if you send me up with fireworks, it's my whole body. Like, that's going to be weird because there's going to be parts of me falling everywhere. Like, you want me to be ash. You don't want me to be an actual body. And it got way dark again, way darker than it ever should have, especially in front of my daughter. And
so now I've got an image of someone actually a body, a corpse in a cannon that shoots out and then gets blown apart into pieces. Like, and then there's some guts here and there's a fingers there and eyeballs there. And then people got to pick him up or
and what then happened? Floating down
now
is
I'm
my
going
hand
down
like,
rabbit
fuck
hole.
Yeah. Okay. So tell me, what was the game that your kid wanted to play?
So my kid, right before bedtime, we're jumping on the bed, getting ready for story time. He jumps on me and he's like, can we play one more game? And I'm like, all right, what is it? What's the game? Let me find it. He says, let's pretend that I'm a cat and I'm locked out. And I have to come into your house because I'm on the street and all of my family's passed away and you let me in and you become my new owner. And I just was like, where did that fucking, like, you could have just said like, hey, I find a stray cat and you're pretending to be a cat. And then I put you in bed and rug you up. And that's like bedtime game for a second, but it turned into, no, my family has passed away and that's why I'm a stray cat. And I started laughing hysterically because he did that thing where a kid looks in your eyes and he's like, we'll pretend I'm a cat. And I'm coming in from off the street and my family has passed away and you pick me up. And I'm like, it really rocked
me. Was there a story or a show that had something
similar? Yeah, I think something had happened in one of the, like, Wreck-It Ralph or something, where they actually point out the fact that all of the princesses, someone in their family dies or is threatened with death. And so, like, and that, like, beheading happens in Aladdin. And so all of these little things where it's like the main character in all of these Disney films, someone in the family is dead. And recently in a lot of the Pixar movies, there's a few dark ones where it's like Up. It starts with, you know, the guy's lost his wife of a million years and it's just him and a dog and he's miserable. Go movie. I'm like, so they're getting introduced to these concepts. And my daughter actually was like, she was talking about something to do with someone passing away. And my son hasn't dealt with that until this week. Like the concept of death being final. Like he understands the concept of like, yeah, someone dies, whatever, but he's not really there yet. Now he's five, he's getting there. So my daughter was like, oh yeah, but such and such, but then, you know, they passed away. And she started to talk to Max about it. And we were like, don't just stop. And she didn't understand. And I said, that particular conversation is something for mom and me to have, not you. She was like, oh, okay. And then it turned into a game of like, so this is a secret. This is something only I know that he doesn't know yet. And I'm like, yes. And we keep it that way until he decides he's ready. And now he's fucking ready. He's making games up like, I'm a cat. Everyone's dead. Go.
Jesus. Shit getting dark at the Moore household, huh?
Dude, yeah, we got to let the kids out a little more. We keep locking them in the basement for too long. We got to put it at 8 hours.
You got to pepper in the breaks. I've learned that you got to pepper in the breaks, especially so that you can clean the cage out. Like, you know, because, you know, you put down the sawdust and stuff. It collects.
Well, we have
really
two buckets.
Fast.
One's a sponge and one's for the... Anyway.
Good callback. Callback. That's a good way to wrap up the encore. Say, bye. Should we do this again?
Thank you very much for hanging out, guys. We love you. Bye.